It's a group of fraternity of men who have all our aim is to make this life on earth just a little more bearable. That you know you got a friend that I can call. Because the whole idea about this is that we call faith, hope, and charity. Well, people that today, they don't understand what words mean. They don't look it up. But charity is nothing but love. It's not pulling a penny out of your pocket and giving it to the next door neighbor. It's pulling a $100 bill to give to him. That's not charity. But charity is love.
All right, so we're back with another episode of Two Dudes, One God Pod. Pat had to deal with an alligator today, so he's not going to be with us. But I have Joe Barron with me today, a local legend. Joe Barron is, among other things, a 33rd degree Mason. And we're probably going to get into some interesting stories. So if you got a subwoofer in your car, you might want to like turn the bass down a little bit, because Joe would probably blow your speakers out. But anyway, Joe, I'm glad to have you on the podcast. We've tried to do this for a long time and we keep rescheduling. We finally got it straight. So the kind of common thread on this podcast is we want to hear people's testimony, how their life went, how they encountered God. And I know you're just full of stories, so we're looking forward to hearing from. Where are you from, Tyler? You grew up here in Tyler?
Yeah, Trey, I am glad to be here. I don't know how long it's taken me to get here, but
yeah.
I was born here. I changed zip codes, though. I have moved around inside Smith County, but stayed basically in Smith County and farmed for years and decided that was killing me. I was working at Kelly Springfield at the same time, but there was those things you did. You worked yourself to death, and then you try to make it to the end of the day, and it all worked out.
So you grew up on a farm?
Yeah. I grew up on a farm. My father and my grandfather, my uncle, his brother-in-law, everybody's family all grew roses out here, out in the New Harmony area. And we farmed, and I don't know if you've heard that song that Blake Shelton sings and about the God's country.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it makes me cry sometimes when I think about that song, because that was basically our story of our life. We farmed all week, and went to church on Sunday, and we passed the plate around, and then gave the money back to God, and then went back to work in the fields again. And it all worked out. Good Lord took care of us. I mean, I was raised that if you believe in the Lord Jesus Christ, and everything would be following right along just fine. And of course, when you're 12 years old, you don't think about things like that. You're just trying to figure out how in the world I'd end up on a tractor at 12 years old. But that's what they did. Yeah, we did all kinds of work. Yeah, we wasn't in a field as hauling hay, clearing fences, making fences. Basically, the rough times of before there were ever anything that was any mention of mechanical persuasion, because everything was done by hand. And it was hard work. We got up every morning, we'd take care of the cows, and then we'd get on the school bus and go to school and come back home, get off the school bus and go out and work till the dark, and then get our books out and start reading and trying to study for something. My brother and I, we did work to everything we could finally make, you know, anything, you know. We've been through our lives, and my life especially, I can tell you where I should have died many times. Most people don't live through the things I have. It took me a long time to figure out that the reason I was put here was because God put me to work. The only reason I'm alive is because I got more work to do.
Hmm.
And that's, I figured that out, but it took 50 years to figure that out, though. You have to go through many trials, and God teaches you all the time. You're learning, and the next thing you know, you're going, how did I make it through that? And, well, you're not old enough to understand yet.
Hmm.
But you get to a point, and you start seeing things, and you see the result of why you were here later, and it ain't real fast. Years may be going by, 7, sometimes 10 years. And then you turn around and you look back and you're going, oh, that's why I was there. And all the things in the farm that we learned about farming and God and trusting the Lord to take care of you, because it's going to be a drought. We have rain. We don't have any rain. And then you wait and you try to make it. And then all of a sudden, toward the end of the year, everything starts coming together. And then you wake up and you go, we had enough of everything we needed. I'm never going to be rich. I don't want to be rich. But I have never went hungry. And it's all because I never got more than anything I needed. Any extra, I just give it away. Because it was just stuff that I didn't need. But I found out that if I go through 6 years old, I went through a windshield. I nearly lost my neck. I basically went through within 10 millimeters of cutting my spinal nerve in two at 6 years old. Split my lip in two. That was one of the weird miracles that I didn't understand, but that was just to keep me alive, I'm sure. Go along and you find out that some of the strangest things. And I start getting in 95, about between 95 and about 80 and 95, bad time. So when I decided there was no such thing as God, everything was a farce. Everything they've told me was a lie. And I turned against God. I turned against the kids. I turned against my family, my mother. I even told my mother that everything she told me about Jesus Christ and the church was wrong. And I said, it's just making up things.
Well, how do you end up like that?
I don't know.
When did you get saved? Did you get saved when you were a kid?
I suppose I was saved when I was 12.
Mm-hmm.
But
you don't think so?
Yeah, I think I was. But boy, things went bad in 1980. I don't know whether it was because I think I was going through a midlife crisis in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't old enough to have that, but it didn't.
How old were you in 80?
35.
Okay.
36. I'd had a successful farming business. I was working at Kelly Springfield. I had plenty of money. I made all kinds of busy. 9 times out of 10, I'd sleep 4 hours a day, working myself to death. Woke up one morning, and I hated Virginia. I hated everything. I didn't want to be around anything. I don't need her anymore, I thought. I tried to run her off.
Hmm.
I had had enough. And she hung in there for 6 solid months. And finally, 6 months later, she hadn't left yet.
She more stubborn than you are.
I don't know. It takes two stubborn people to stay married 51 years.
Hmm.
You have to be stubborn on both sides. You can't be stubborn in one, it doesn't take it. Both got to be holding fast to the times when the ship starts sailing and you go into a storm. Somebody's got to hold on to the mast, you know. And we've held on together sometimes. Sometimes I just hold on, and sometimes it's just her. But she held on that time. Good grief. But about 6 months later, I couldn't figure out what was going on because I think the devil had took hold of me. because I was really wanting everybody to go. I wanted to leave town, leave the house, never come back. But she kept coming and telling me to come back. And finally I did. And I walked in the door and I told her I was sorry. And we've been building on that ever since. We'd been married. We got married in 1974. She was 17, I was 18. That was nuts. Two kids. But she was the only one that went to finish school in high school. She finished her senior year, married to me in 1974. This is funny. 6 weeks later, after she started school, to come in there with a report card and told me that I needed to sign a report card. Oh no, that can't be right. That can't be right.
But you dropped out of high school?
No, I didn't drop out. I finished school. Was going to TJC to learn how to be an ag teacher. And then Kelly Springfield was hiring, and you can make more money than an ag teacher first year and didn't even have to go to school. So I sent me to go there. After that, Virginia decided that I had a good job. We could get married. Sounds like a good idea to me, so we did. But she got married after her junior year. Started her senior year in May, or September, and we got married in July. Hmm. She was the only one, high school senior that had her own car in her own house and was living a life of luxury in 1975. Now, graduated 75. But she went across the stage 9 months later, 5 months pregnant. And she picked up her diploma, and the rest is history.
How do you meet Virginia?
In the high school cafeteria. Senior in high school, saw that sophomore walk by and I went, I'd like to know who her name is. And God put us together. She needed me. I needed her. We needed to be each other now, but she needs me a lot more sometimes than I need her, but I never quit. But she is steadfast with her belief with me, and her belief in God is unshaken. Can't move her from that. And so that's how we stayed married, basically. All the troubles we had. And I look back, and I'm glad I hung around. Because it's been 51 years, and I would probably bet maybe 2 years out of that 51 was bad, but you've got to put them all together to make it 2 years. But it's all good.
Well, I want to go back a little bit. What was home life like for you? What was your relationship like with your folks?
Oh, man. You live with a cop. You know what it'd be like. A cop for 30 years. You couldn't get away with nothing. Especially in driving a truck. He would look at the windshield and say, that bug hitting that windshield at 75 miles an hour. Wow. I believed him. I mean, he's a cop. What did he, you know, he bound to know what it looks like, a bug hitting a windshield at 75 miles an hour. Why not? So I said, oh, man. And good grief, you want to talk about getting pulled over? Huh? I had fear. Total fear that it was my dad in that car that pulled me over. I just knew it was going to be bad. But it wasn't. But that was terror. But Dad wasn't dad. Something most 9 times out of 10 it wasn't him. But he was a cop and a good one. He always told me, he said that he'd worked 30 years, something like that. Never pulled his gun out. Not one time. Said he didn't pull a gun out to show it to you and let you look at it. He pulled it out to do what it needed to be done.
Where was he a cop?
Here in Tyler. But he never pulled a gun out. He didn't see any need in it. He didn't see no need shooting anybody. Everybody he come up on didn't need to be shot, so he didn't pull his gun out. And many times he did. get into confrontation. I still remember coming up on a corner of a house, and a woman was on the other side and about to kill her husband. And she threw her arm out to point at the gun, and the gun come right in front of his face at the corner where he was standing. And he reached and grabbed the gun out of her hand, and the hammer hit his fingers. Hmm. Took it away from her. Some of those things like that. But Mom was totally, to the day she died, unwavering in her faith in Jesus Christ. Sometimes she would do it, and I would talk to her, and I would tell her, Mom, you're just going to go home. You're dying, but it's going to be a whole lot better. I think that's the reason I see death as just a temporary thing. Mm. I do that because I've seen death too many times. And it's just a passing. And when my mom died, I sang Amazing Grace to her. Mm. And she had been in a coma for almost 2 days right before she died. And then when I sang that to her, she opened her eyes up and died. So I know that the passing is just a temporary thing. I look at death. I think it's going to as many funerals as I have been, doing Masonic funerals and all. And it is a sad situation when you only have the people there is you and the family, and only 7 people of the family, and there's 5 of you, and no pallbearers. I don't want to die like that. I want to have friends. Mm-hmm. But if you live long enough, you outlive your friends, and then there's nobody there. And that happens. Not that you didn't have friends, you just outlived them. I'll show you for living so long. But it's all good.
So what did you do for Kelly Springfield? You were
I started out a tire builder.
Okay.
Building tires. I did that 10 years, and after 10 years, I decided I should have stayed in school. The tire machine was killing me, and I was trying to bale hay and farm at the same time. That wasn't working out too well. So I would just build tires and the minimum amount of tires. And after 10 years, I decided that, you know, hey, we're going to have to do something else. So I went back to school, and I got my computer science degree. I'm going to learn how to work on computers in 1989. Mm-hmm. That's when the DOS started. Did that DOS 2. Mm-hmm. Disk Operating System 2. I know nobody knows what that is now. But it's all working off of DOS. Everything, it's your phone, well, not your iPhone. That thing's working up. Sorry. That thing's working off of Apple. Mm-hmm. Apple's got the same operating system. It's still running off the same operating system they came up with in 1989. They just refined it. Mm-hmm. They built on it. Same way with Gates. He built up on DOS and made Windows. And next thing you know, he's got Microsoft going like crazy. But I went to school to learn how to do that. And after about 2 years, got my degree. I said, hey, we're going to start an apprenticeship program out here at Kelly. And if you want to be a millwright or electrician, a pipe fitter, a machinist, you can apply for it. And if you pass the test, well, you'll get to be on the millwright list or whatever. Called a friend of mine up. I told him, I said, you got 6 weeks to teach me algebra. He said, what? I said, you got 6 weeks to teach me algebra. I can't do it in 6 weeks, he says. I believe that if I pray hard enough and I do enough due diligence and working with it, I believe that I will pass this test. But I've got to have you help me. 6 weeks later, I scored 94, passed the test, and I got on an apprenticeship program, and I decided I didn't need to go work on computers. I could stay there at Kelly Springfield and work on computers and be a millwright at the same time. So it come in handy, knowing how to work on computers and to be a millwright.
And what's a millwright?
He's an overcompensated employee, I think. That's what they told me. A millwright is a specialist. He does everything as far as moving, lining, getting everything lined up to where that looks like God made it, not where you can see it. It's too much. The instruments I used to measure were in the 10,000ths of an inch instead of a quarter of an inch, eighth of an inch. I would measure into thousandths and split it up to a thousandths. Mm. 1/1000 of an inch in every inch, and then you can split them up into 10,000ths, and then you can just forget about it because then you can't see it anyway. You barely can see it with a 40,000 thickness of a hair. I measured them one time. We got bored. How thick is a hair? 40. Oh, okay. Like we really knew that and didn't care either. But when you set up turbines, and think of the biggest thing you could imagine, it would be Hoover Dam.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the guys who set the bearings in there for the hydroelectric plant and set the hydroelectric plant together were millwrights. There were no pipe fitters. Pipe fitters all run the piping, going to the cooling towers and cooling it and keeping everything cool. And the electricians made sure the electricity would run. But as far as those big bearings of the size of school buses, those are millwrights that put those in. And it had to be within 5,000ths of an inch tolerance, perfectly straight, perfectly level, so that when you put a level on it, I've still got my level that measured 5,000ths of an inch every foot. If it was off that much level, it would go stupid. It'd go too far to the right or left, but it wouldn't be in the middle. And it had to be in the middle when you got through. So you did that, and you started to figure how many thousands of inch went up to each foot, be 4 feet underneath each machine.
So you set up machines within five thousandths of a foot.
Well, 5,000ths of an inch.
5,000ths of an inch. Yeah, 5,000ths of an inch. Well, how do you, I mean, these are big things. These are big, heavy things. How do you move them?
Very carefully.
Yeah, like with a forklift or something?
Yeah, no, you have to use them with jacks and timbers and hydraulic lifts, and you're using hydraulic things. The best thing I loved was this thing weighed 65,000 pounds, and we were trying to get we needed to get 5,000ths of an inch closer to the coupling. So we was trying to move it every which way we could. Every time we'd use a hydraulic jack, it'd move too much, just too near. Finally, I told the boy, go up back in the back, take a 1,600-pound sledgehammer and hit the fire out of it and hit it as hard as you can and see if it will move.
It weighs 65,000 pounds?
Yeah, and it was on steel, so it's going to move. How much is it going to move? Don't know. We just hit it. And at that time, I had my dial indicators on it, and it hit it, and it moved 1,000ths of an inch. I need 4 more hits. Hit it again. He did it 2 and 3. And the 4th time he hit it, whether it be the 5th time that he hit it, it didn't move. He got tired. I got somebody else back there. Hit it 1 more time. So he hit it 1 more time. Moved right into where it was tolerance, and that was perfectly straight.
Golly.
But it's amazing how much you can move. So much weight if you just have enough force. And you can move it. And it was those things, the things that tell you can't do that. And a millwright would get an engineer, and the engineer would get with the millwright, and he'd show him how to build it, and then he would put it together, and then we'd make it happen. So you can't do it without the engineer. You've got to have him.
Hmm.
He's the one who does all the drawings and everything. He does all the drawings. But we make it practical and put it together, and everything's good.
Interesting. So how many years did you do that kind of work?
20 years I did that. Worked with some mighty fine people. They taught me many things. Those are craftsmen. That's back when you had craftsmen.
Right.
You know, electrician, craftsmen, pipe fitters. I've watched pipe fitters put together tubing and put it on the side of a machine. It looked like an interstate highway out there. Just each turn was turning the same way, all the piping. Just don't see that anymore. Unless you're getting from Iraq or Iran. We used to have an apprenticeship program set up down there in Houston for pipe fitters, and they don't even have that no more. Haven't had it in 40 years. They'd take young men and teach them how to be pipe fitters. Well, they didn't need them anymore. They start hiring them outside. It's funny how they now are starting to understand that they shipped all their jobs overseas and they don't have any craftsmen here. Don't have any craftsmen to build it anymore. All the old craftsmen like me are all retired. There are very few millwrights and very few pipe fitters laying around. Electricians are all over the place, but a lot of them not industrial electrician, they're residential. And then industrial is the one that's moving 4,400 volts and weird things like that.
So you did that time there. When did you, what kind of church did you grow up going to?
New Harmony Baptist Church, North Baptist American Church. Baptist Missionary Association.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. We sang out of Red Broadman Hymnal, and I love singing those old songs. They don't do that anymore.
What's your favorite hymn?
I think Amazing Grace really is. But we had that Broadman Hymnal. And I love that. Everybody tell you, turn to page 335 for He Walks With Me. Okay. Well, we all knew the song, but we went to the book anyway. We don't have books anymore. Now we read up on the screen, no music, no notes, no nothing, just words. And then they sing songs that I don't understand anymore. They sing songs I like the song, I like the words, but I don't know how to sing that song. I listen to them. They sound great, but I can't sing with them. Not anymore.
Well, I'm sure you sing bass. There's not many songs out now.
No, there's no demand for bass singers anymore, baritones. Not even in demand from them, unless you want me to sing Johnny Cash. Well, we can do that, but they don't. Johnny Cash sang a lot of Christian songs. He did a good job. But no, there's not any songs out there for bass singers. All these high-pitched guys, they sound good. I ain't got nothing to get them. But you can't have Daddy Sing Bass. You can't have that anymore.
What about when did you first get introduced to Freemasonry?
I always wanted to be a Mason. I just didn't know how. I knew guys that were Masons, but everybody that I knew a Mason were craftsmen. Okay, they're all in maintenance. I'm not in maintenance. When I got into maintenance as an apprentice, I can get into masonry now. I'm a craftsman. And then I asked the old boy to get me in the lodge. He said, "What took you so long?" Well, I told him. "Oh, good grief," he says. "Anybody that asks if he's a good man can be a mason. You just have to ask." I didn't know that. I asked, but I waited 15 years later.
Really?
Yeah. I knew guys were Masons 15 years prior to that, and I was sitting there going, "I don't know how to do this." But men that I knew were craftsmen and very good men. They were involved in the community. They were involved in their church. They were involved with us at the Kelly Springfield. They were involved in the union. They were involved in everything. And I was sitting there going, "I don't think I can be a Mason." And then they told me, "No, you don't have to do all that. You just go. Be a Mason. Be a true to yourself and true to your God and true to your family." Is that it? Yeah. Oh, wow. So I jumped in there. And then that's when I figured out I was back there several years prior to me turning against God. I was coming back, but it was slow. But when I got in the lodge and he told me, he said, "I am here You've been looking around trying to find me, and I am right by in your heart. I didn't have to turn around. He was right there with me. God had been with me the whole time. I thought he'd forsaken me. I thought I'd done everything wrong he could possibly do, and then come to find out he'd been there all the time.
Was that what happened? Did you think that you had done too much wrong, or did something really bad happen to you that put you into that dark time?
No, I didn't. Nothing really bad happened to me. I've been blessed. Well, I didn't really have anything bad happen. I mean, other than sailing my fingers off a chainsaw, that was not good, but it turned out all right.
Yeah, you got your fingers now, don't you?
Yeah. You know, that's when I come understanding what was going on. Me and God got in a talk, face-to-face talk on that deal. I was trained to be a millwright and lost my fingers. The doctor said I'm going to cut them off. I said, I can't have you cut them off. I have to be a craftsman. I have to have both my hands working. I can't do this without both hands. He said, well, I'm going to have to cut them off. I said, you just worry about tying the knot. I said, God's going to take care of this. He was an atheist, of course. He thought he was God. I said, you just tie the knot. We'll let God take care of the rest of it. Well, he tied the knot. Took him 3 days to do that. That sucked, but we got it done. About 2-3 weeks later, he wouldn't even send me to therapy. But I'd drive down the road trying to make my fingers work. I couldn't get them past 20 degrees. But every day I'd move them, and I'd look down there and, 3 months later, I went in the doctor's office, and he had his back to me. He says, go ahead and make your fist, Joe. I did. He said, that's not even supposed to happen. You don't have anything in your hand to make that fist. All the metacarpuses, all the little bones, the nerves, everything is not there, and there's not any reason for that to work. I said, I will tell you why it works. It's because God healed my hand. Nobody else did. You already decided you wanted to cut them off, so we already got you out of the equation. The only thing left is God, because I am not smart enough to know how to make this work. Yet it does. So you can sit there and tell me you don't believe in miracles. I'm carrying one in my left arm. It's called my left hand. That was the first one. Those things, you go in there and I try to tell people in churches and Sunday schools, and nobody really takes that serious about how my hand is a true miracle, because they have no idea the pain that I went through to get that today to do that. But how did I get the strength to go through that? And it felt like a number 10 nail spike was going in my hand every day. But it's there. It's 1/4 inch shorter on that side. You know, the length of a chainsaw. I mean, the width of a chainsaw. But those are things. And people say, oh, God doesn't do any miracles anymore. Well, no, we don't have people standing on a street corner healing you. We don't have to have that anymore. I believe God is out there with you. And a lot of times he doesn't see fit to have that fixed. Sometimes it is fixed. But if it is fixed, then something's got to go. You're going to have to learn what you're going to have to do, because you're not going to give God the opportunity. The opportunity is coming from him. What you do with it is your business. If you want to take that and run with it, and God says, okay, here's your opportunity, are you going to serve me or are you going to not? Well, that's your choice. And I don't think I want to say no. I don't want to take that chance. So if I get thrown at an opportunity of doing something, my grandson was born, my youngest one. They told me he wouldn't ever walk, wouldn't ever talk. Been 3 years old and he's not talking, not walking, not doing anything. And I prayed to God, I said, give me something. I need to know what I can do. I know you've put me in this place to help people. Let me help my grandson. And I got hold of a person, another Mason, who got me with a friend of his within, at the Hancock Building, of all things, in Chicago, whose daughter was a PhD in neuropsychology. She lived in Mexico, and she told me, we need to do this and this and this. About a week later, she called me on the phone. She said, what's Melissa's phone number? She said, I know Melissa's not going to do this until I tell her. You tell her, it's just going to pass by. She's going to ignore you. You're a father. It's a normal thing. I'm going to tell her. She called Melissa on the phone. Melissa sees that and says, if she's going to take the time to call me from Mexico, maybe I need to listen. So she did what she told her. 6 weeks later, she changed all of her preservatives, cooking off the stove instead of the microwave, doing all the natural foods, doing all these changing up. And 6 weeks later, Carson stood up for the first time. 6 weeks later, he was talking 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Got to 10. But that was the best he could do. 3 months later, Carson walked up the stairs, had my belt in his hand. He said, Papa, you left your belt on the floor. I grabbed him up and ran him downstairs. I said, tell Mama what you said. A complete sentence. His brain had been released. He's been 3 years behind ever since then. But he's now 18 years old, going on 15. What a deal. I wish I could do that. But every year, he's improving. He ended up playing an all-star game in the football and a baseball, throwing 85-mile-an-hour baseballs.
No way.
Yeah. These are things he grew up to be. All because God put me in place to make contact with others. And the best part was when Melissa said, my dad goes around saving the world, but he stopped long enough to save my child. I'm a hero. So, hey, you can't beat that with a stick. No, you ain't gonna do that. it's all good.
So, now that you're a 33rd degree, you know, Mason, you know all the secrets of the Illuminati and everything.
Yeah, I don't even know who this Illuminati bunch is. I saw it on Da Vinci Code. I did go to Roslyn Chapel, but I did it before Da Vinci Code come out. I knew that Roslyn Chapel was a pretty cool place to go for a Mason, so I flew out there to go see it. But this is before the Da Vinci Code, and then my daughter was going to school or work, I don't remember which, Sunday school, whatever it was, and they asked her, did you see the Da Vinci Code? My daughter said, yes, my daddy's been there. She said, your daddy's been to Roslyn? Yes. He said the whole thing was a bunch of malarkey. Well, they don't even have a crypt. I mean, you know, they went down in a crypt down in the Da Vinci Code. They don't even have a crypt that has books. And then they're talking about the Illuminati, and I'm going, I've been invited several times from people who say they are Illuminati. And from what I gathered on reading about Illuminati, if they have to call you, then they didn't need you. I don't know nothing about them, but from what I gathered, they're pretty smart. And they don't want me in there. That's for scientists and everything else. And I'm going, I'm not a scientist. I'm not a Rhodes Scholar. I'm just old Joe Barron, come out of Kelly Springfield, worked in high school. And you're sitting there telling me y'all want to be an Illuminati. I said, I think you're not really there. I think this whole Illuminati thing is some kind of hoax just to make people think it's there. Some guy's he's the lionest man I ever seen on a podcast, on this Facebook. He's talking about how the Knight Templars were taking over the world, and I'm sitting there going, Really? I mean, I'm a 33rd. I don't know anything about us taking over the world. We can't hardly even agree on what we're going to have for supper next week.
Yeah, I can attest to that.
I know. How are we going to agree to take over the world if we can't even agree on no thing? We have awards that we give to each other. And a 33rd is nothing more than an award for working yourself to death in the lodge. Me, I taught over 180 guys back then and got 100 and so then member of the Scottish Rite, and I got to be a 33rd simply because I worked myself to death getting these guys in, teaching them, got them all taught, and then they got in the lodge and joined the Scottish Rite, and I got a hat.
What are you teaching them? I mean, what's the point of that Freemason
really
stuff?
Teaching. He's not really teaching anything. It's more retention of memory. If you memorize enough that you do, it's kind of like memorizing scriptures in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we memorize in the lodge. We memorize all these places and everywhere in the Bible. We're sitting there going, I mean, you say it, but you don't understand it. So you go back and look and you go find it in the Bible. Oh, that was where that was at. Or somebody, a preacher will say it, and how good and how pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity. And I'm going, I know that verse. That's in Psalms. Oh, okay. But my mother wanted us to memorize all the books of the Bible. You know, everybody did. Didn't really understand why. And, you know, it's like that woman was talking about certain things broke the law in the Bible. And I said, well, yeah, that's in Leviticus. The book of the law is in Leviticus. You can't plant any plants. The same plant, you can't do an opposite plant. You can't plant corn and plant peas next to it. You got to plant all corn. Well, nobody does that anyway. It's kind of ridiculous. When you're planting crops, you plant all one crop and then move over to the next crop. And that's the thing about the Bible. It's so great about the Bible. Nobody understands half the thing it's teaching, but most of it's teaching you how to be clean. A lot of it is. A lot of it has to do with food. Don't eat pork. Okay? Why didn't they not eat pork? Because it would spoil too quickly and you would die of food poisoning.
I ate pork today.
Well, yeah, but it's refrigerated. You can fry it. You're good. And you don't have worms in it on top of that. Back there, pork would have worms. I hate them things. And one that scared me to death when I was growing up in school and going to school, and they tell you in the ag class, watch out for the trichina worms. That was eating raw pork, or almost raw, that wasn't cooked, and it didn't kill the worm, and if it didn't kill the worm, it'd get into your skin and eat up in your bones and your muscle tissue, and then you'd crunch when you walked. Trichina worms. Nasty little things. But you'd get that from eating pork. Unclean animals. And lambs they're all clean. You could eat a lamb all you want to. You can hang them up in a smokehouse all you want to. Can't do that. Couldn't do that with pork. But now we got all these fancy little gadgets, smoking. We can barbecue ribs and everything else. We can do anything with pork we want to now. But you couldn't do it now then. You'd get sick. That's why you didn't eat it. Pretty cool.
Well, so when did you finally become a Mason?
Oh, 95.
1995.
Yeah.
So
I went that. I got in the lodge, and the first guy, right after I got in my third degree, I started teaching another guy, and then another guy, and another guy. Next thing you know, I ended up getting in the lodge, and I was an officer and made worship master in 2000. And I wanted to join everything I could possibly do it because my mama said it was a cult. And I said, I'm going to find out. What's this? I said, I'm going to get involved in everything. So I got involved in the Scottish Rite, the York Rite, the Shrine. And I got involved in the lodge and I buried myself into that thing. And I have yet to find anything to be a cult about it. I don't know what they're talking about being a cult. I just, if they say it's a cult of people that don't know anything about it, and they just read it something in the news or read it on Facebook or Google it, and they say, well, I hate that blooming Discovery Channel, History Channel. Mm-hmm. They know that, right? Are you kidding me? We go through the rituals. Yeah, we got secrets, but actually not. You can find.
Yeah, I mean, you can find it online, but you won't know what's real and what's not.
No,
but
you don't know what is that.
The point is that it's a shared experience that we go through.
Exactly.
And if somebody told you all the stuff that was going to happen, it wouldn't mean as much to you when you went through it.
No, it wouldn't.
But what do you say to people that say that it's like Jehovah's Witness or Mormonism or some of these wild Catholics that think that you can worship, there's people that say, well, the problem is that you're going to identify as something else before a Christian, right? You're going to identify as a Mason, or you're taking some kind of an oath or something against, that precludes you from God. But, I mean, they say that it won't interfere with your duty to God, right? But Jews and Muslims can be a Mason. So how do you square that? It's not a Christian organization,
no,
right?
No, it's not. But
everything we do is biblical, right?
Yeah, everything we do. And
do the Jews and the Muslims square that?
Well, when you go to the courthouse.
No pun intended.
I understand.
I didn't mean to say square that.
I understand. But you go into the courthouse.
Mm-hmm.
You see, in God we trust.
Mm-hmm.
And when you take the oath, of office or oath of the jury or witness stand, so help me God, the Jew is happy. The Muslim is happy. And the Christian is happy. Because in God we trust. We have not put a name on him. But everybody is happy that they're God. And it's all, people call God different names. Yahweh, Jehovah, Adoniram. All these names that we have for God. And it's all whether or not how you believe is your business, not mine. I can't tell you that going to Wilderness Church is just wrong. That's what I love about my church over at Flint Baptist. Sam DeVille, wonderful guy. He said, you know, there's a place for everybody. There's a place for people down up there on the 271 to go to the cowboy church up there. There's a place for the Presbyterian to go over here. And there's a place for the Baptist to go over here. We're all trying to get to the same place. We're just taking different roads. So how do we have... Who am I to say the Church of Jesus Christ is the Wilderness Church? God didn't have, Jesus didn't start a denomination.
Yeah, I follow what you're saying. Like, you know, I'm suspect of religion and religious people too.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just trying to follow Jesus.
That's
I think
it.
That's where you're getting. But then what's the point of Masonry? What's the point of Blue Lodge?
Because God put us on this earth to help each other.
To be in community.
Now, you're going to start at birth and you're going to die.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to do with that? What are you going to do with your life between the time you live, born, and the time you die? Are you going to be a drone on society? Or are you going to be a helper? And that's what Masonry is making you practice that. Because we are all in this together. And if one is hurting, we need to know the one is hurting. You keep it to yourself, we don't know. We can't get to you. If you're going in a coma and your wife doesn't call us to tell us you had a bad car wreck, but if she calls us, you will never know how many men will be praying for you to get better. It's a group of fraternity of men who have all our aim is to make this life on earth just a little more bearable, that you know you got a friend that I can call. Because the whole idea about this is that we call faith, hope, and charity. Well, people that today, they don't understand what words mean, they don't look it up. But charity is nothing but love. It's not pulling a penny out of your pocket and giving it to the next door neighbor. It's pulling a $100 bill to give it to him. That's not charity. But charity is love. And without that love, you cannot have faith. And without that love, you cannot have hope. And that's what we believe in, is giving hope with our love for each other. And our faith in God gives us that charity. And it wasn't for God giving us the gift of love. We wouldn't have that gift. Then we couldn't love anybody. There are people out there who do not have that gift. They don't care about you and anything other than what they can get out of life, and they're going to go with it. And that is the ones we don't want in there. But the ones who care for their families, and they want, hey, I say, Trey, I got some problems. You ain't going to believe it. And I tell you what that problem is. I don't have to worry about it going to the next door neighbor's house. That's the kind of belief and honor between two men, is have that honor between each other, that I can tell you something without you telling somebody else and having to worry about that secret getting out. And there's a lot of times we tell each other something that we don't, nobody know about this. But you ain't going to believe it when I tell you. And you have to have that kind of camaraderie with each other, because you have to have trust. And if you don't have that trust, then you can't have any faith at all. There has to be a drawing the line somewhere where we have to, that I can depend on somebody. I'm not alone here. God's with me, but God put me friends with me. My friends are here with me. I've got my brothers. I can make a phone call at any time and have the whole world come down on this.
Well, you know, you bring up a good point. There's history is just filled with Masonic stories. And I got kind of deep a little while back. I was watching Tombstone, and I noticed that one of the cowboys in Tombstone had a square and compass necklace on. And then I started researching online and reading historical documents, and it turns out that I don't know that movie was so accurate. I think that the whole problem that they were having, what kicked off that whole rivalry, was somehow somebody didn't get into a Masonic lodge.
Really?
Because a cowboy voted him out or something, and it was one of Wyatt Earp's brothers or something, couldn't get into the lodge because of it. And that's what started that whole disagreement, you know. So I don't know if somebody's out there, if they want to research it or they know the information, I'd love to have you on the podcast to hear more about it. But, you know, you told me you went to New York City and saw an official document shows that General Santa Anna was a Mason.
Yeah.
And I've heard stories about Nazi Germany, you know, during World War II, people, you know, prisoners of war, you know, from the Allied forces, you know, being there and throwing up a sign or something and just having extra food the whole time that they were in captivity. And I mean, there's stories of people jumping into foxholes and realizing that they were enemies, but they were also brothers, and going, hey, we're just going to agree to walk the other direction, you know. So it's kind of like having a universal A&M ring that no matter where in the world you go.
That's basically it.
If you are a Mason and you make that known, because it gives you the ability to travel, right? Like in theory, right?
That's what it was all designed for. A lot of times back then, the guilds, in the medieval times when they were building the castles, the Masons were building the castles, and they got to be master Masons. And masters were the ones who built the cathedrals all over. And then they would go to another country, and they'd go to that country, and they would be able to get a job because they were masters, and they would know what they were doing, and they would be used to build the castles even more. And during World War II, they were trying to go through the lodge as fast as they were going through basic training, because they knew that Germans were Masons too. They were not all evil. Although they did try to blow up the Hitler.
Well, Hitler was trying to figure out, he wanted in on the, he thought that there was some kind of esoteric magic that
we knew, he did.
You know, he was in on the thing. And then they had the little flowers or whatever they put on, the forget-me-not, you know, was a symbol. And, you know, the Catholic Church hated Masons for a long time, it seemed like. You know, they hunted down, well, I mean, you know, they...
Pope doesn't like us. I don't know that.
Well, hell, the Pope brought an idol into the Vatican and said that all religions go to heaven and they worship some idol in the Vatican in 2024. Really? You didn't see that?
I don't keep up with
that. God, dog, boy, they're in trouble, you know. It seems like a whole hill of mess.
It is a mess.
But what, you know, Washington was a Mason. You know, I've been explained to me that the whole Boston Tea Party was a Masonic lodge organized that deal, you know.
That's a pretty known fact that the Tea Party was started that night in the lodge of Red Dragon Lodge. Wrote in the minutes that we had to close the lodge a little early tonight because of a prior engagement. And then later on, the Tea Party took off. Whether that was them or not, I don't know. Sure did look awful coincidental that it was, but who knows? I don't know that for sure. Only the shadow knows for sure. But the things we've done, and God has taught us that we're to be charitable with everything, especially our children. That's why we have the Shriners Hospitals and built the Shriners Hospitals, 22 of them all across the United States, to help children.
And you're on the board right now, aren't you?
I'm on the hospital board for the Shreveport Hospital. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, Shreveport Clinic, not a hospital. We don't have people in the beds anymore. Mm. But we do treat our children free. Not actually free, but if you got insurance, we take the insurance. If you don't, you're not going to go in there and get charged for it. But it's always helping children, and that's what our goal is, and God told us to take care of the children, so that's what we're doing.
And then we had there's a boys' home, or there was, I guess, in the Dallas area for a long time.
Orphans' home, and then we had a Masonic home for widowed ladies. Now we got the Texas Masonic Retirement Center for aged Masons.
Mm-hmm.
Mason can't afford to live on anywhere else. He just goes up there and they'll take care of you.
And, you know, I was surprised to find out that the lodge that I'm at, that we're at together, is, you know, St. John's 53 here in Tyler. It was the public school for children. It was a no-cost public school for children here in Tyler before public school system was invented.
Yeah, and that was, thing was, we know, and that's another thing Masonry believes in, is an educated public.
Mm-hmm.
That if you can have an educated public, then you can have an educated electorate.
Mm-hmm.
But if you get to the point where that nobody's thinking for themselves and they don't want it to think for themselves and they elect somebody to think for them, then they realize that they elected somebody that is full of mischief, and they realize that they need to start thinking instead of letting him do all the thinking. Then next thing you know, you're going to get rid of him and re-elect somebody else in there. But you may get rid of him, but you ain't going to get rid of the mischief. The mischief still follows him. And that's why we've been trying to teach an educated public. That's why we started the schools, and some of the Ivy League schools were started by Masons. And then you had the Presbyterians. I love them. They started all their schools, and they know that they have to have an educated public, because as long as we can get them educated. But today's education has gone so skewed of trying to say, well, we need to have this, this, and this, and forget about the values of God. And we forgot about that. And now the schools are skewed. And we got to get away from it.
Well, I saw something the other day I wanted to check with you about, because, you know, I don't know that we really know where Masonry began, but we believe that it came from the operative Masons around the, you know, medieval times or whatever. Well, there's all these videos popping up now talking about Tartaria. You know about this?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, if you go to like Denver, Colorado, for example, and you look at their Capitol building, or you look at the, you know, the architecture, you know, these massive, crazy buildings are all just carved out of solid granite, you know, all over. You can go all over and see this stuff, right?
Okay.
And so there's this theory. I mean, if you think about that big world fair, they put it up and then they tore it down. You know what I mean? Like we somehow, when we had boats and horses and carriages, we built the most amazing craftsmanship, amazing buildings. And they did it in a year, year and a half. Wrigley Field is one of them. You know, yeah. Hell, they built that thing in like less than a year. And then if you look at, there's no real pictures of it, you know, from back then, you know. So there's this theory that there was this previous race to us, and there were the Tatarians or something, and they had some kind of a technology that we don't understand, and they built all this stuff. And this goes back, you know, Nikola Tesla, free energy, you know. They think that all these buildings were built to somehow harness or receive or create free energy. But like, how do they do all this stuff? They built these massive buildings, you know, and they did it with a craftsmanship that we don't know now, because I mean, it takes them forever to build stuff now comparatively, and we have cranes and all kinds of equipment.
Well, you can say that, but and everybody says, well, I don't understand how they would do that. Well, the reason they don't understand that is because a layman about doing any kind of craft work is not going to understand it. Millwright understands it. I mean, we were probably the first millwrights. I mean, the stone cutters, they had to have a crane operator and a rigger to pick up those big monster blocks and move them. And when we moved, it's like one of the guys we were using hoist to lift up our 65,000 pound machine out 12 foot out of a hole, and put it up on the side of the floor and then shove it out on the second floor. How did we do that? Well, it did it 2 inches at a time. Okay? And no, if you haven't had an idea of how to move monsters, massive. Now, we did this. We took 65,000 pound machine, went up 2 inches, shored it up, and then put 2 inches higher, and put boards underneath that and made it four. And we do it 2 inches at a time until we got to 12 inches high. And when we finally got it 12 inches high, we put a 12 by 12 underneath it board and shoved it underneath there. And then we went 12 foot doing that all the way up till we got 12 foot high. Now, we did that in 2 days. Okay? If you don't know how to move big monstrous things, it doesn't seem possible. But we could. I told that boy that was an apprenticeship with me. I told him, I said, hey, the hoist is broken. He said, what do we do now? I said, we go back the old way with the Egyptians, big boy. We're going to move it a little at a time. Same way the Egyptians moved the big blocks, 2 inches at a time.
Well, you know, there's some thought that maybe they did that because they just floated them down the river.
Well, yeah, could have.
Well, look, here's an example. Have you seen a picture of Galveston City Hall in 1900?
Not really. I would bet probably. Oh, yeah.
Well, how'd they build that?
Very carefully, apparently.
Yeah, no. I mean, the problem is it's like stones that were floated over on a boat from Europe somewhere, right, or the Middle East. You know, they get this granite, these huge pieces of granite. Well, how do they make this stuff?
They can't. You know? Cut it with a stone cutter.
Well, who cut it? We didn't have diamond blades. We didn't have electric drills.
No.
How'd they do this stuff?
They made their own tools.
Like how'd they build that?
Is that Notre Dame, or is that the one in Cologne? Looks like the one in Cologne.
I'm about to tell you. Hold on, let me see if I can get it opened up here. Oh, hell, it's in another language, and I can't read it.
Oh, let me see. Is it German?
But look at this kind of stuff, dude.
Yeah, I know.
I don't know where that is.
I've been there in Europe. I loved it. You see all the architecture in Europe. And
well, how did they make it? And we've got buildings here that look just as wild.
Yeah.
But the theory is that it was all buried. You understand?
Oh,
that
really?
It was a previous. Like, here, let me show you this. Let me see if I can pull this video up. It'll be... Let's see, Tartaria, Denver.
Well, that's almost about like believing the world's flat.
Well, do you think the earth's flat?
Yeah, because when people leave town, they never come back.
Let's see here. This might be it. Let's see what we got. Okay, look. I'm going to play this, and maybe the audio will come through here. Maybe it won't.
So up here, you got the seat of power. You can see right there, that little building there over my shoulder. That's the Masonic Scottish Rite building.
Okay.
Here's the Capitol, the stonemason built Capitol with the dome on top there. The resonator, the power building, the old power structure there, and right across right there, can't really see it, is the it's another Mason built building there. But the seat of power here in Denver, the Masons, the Babylonian, Greco-Roman architecture, Lucifer's seat.
That's
where they get
it. I love that, the seat of power, but I'm sitting there going, Babylonian, he has, that dome, if you want to get particular about it, is a dome of, as the Temple of Vesta.
Hmm.
Okay. And you've heard about the Vestal Virgins?
Mm-hmm.
Down below, they would build a fire down below and then build up into the Temple of Vesta, keep everybody warm. That was a dome, and it come up, get heat, hit the top, and then roll back down, warm up all the pilgrims. That's what that was, the Vestal Virgins.
Yeah, so, like, look, here's the the Chicago Fair here. You see that building?
Yeah. Beautiful building.
Yeah, where is it?
I don't know. It ain't in San Francisco anymore.
This was Chicago in 1893. How did they build that?
The things that they had. I mean, we had.
Look, check this one out.
Please notice how there's a mound, right? Why is there a big mound there?
Because they dug it up.
Because they tried to bury it. But what's amazing is you got the Denver State Capitol here made out of pure granite in like 1900s, right? And then over here, you've got this massive building I'll show you in a minute, too. You've got another massive building behind it. You've got the church behind that. You got another one right there.
Well, when you're simple-minded, it is really just hard to understand it.
Well, hold on.
You do that with horse and buggy. Build a solid building out of granite, right, with chisels and horse and buggies. Mm-hmm. Hmm, look at this granite. Just flawless. With hammer and chisel and horse and buggy. Just flawless. Stacks and stacks and stacks of granite. Plus, way over there, we showed you the courthouse, right? Look, they built this in 1901. What an amazing feat they did. Isn't that amazing? Come to Denver, look at what we got. Tartarian buildings everywhere.
So the thing is, when you're simple-minded, you don't understand it. You can't understand what work engineering feat went through it, because you make a cantilever, you can swing a cantilever, grease the
Well, why'd we stop building that stuff, man? It was beautiful. Yeah. We build all this garbage stuff now. It takes forever. It costs a bunch of money.
It's cheaper. It doesn't cost you anything to compare to what it did back then. You know, billions and millions of dollars to build a building, because that was only labor they had and the only material they had to work with.
Hmm.
Had they had those stucco and clay bricks back then, they'd have used them. That's what they're doing now, because it's cheaper to build it with stucco and clay bricks. Cheaper. And the thing, it's the way of the thing. You want to talk about something crazy, is my grandfather helped build the airport at Tyler.
Mm-hmm.
With a wagon. He hauled iron ore from the top of that hill by my uncle's house in New Harmony, and they carried every bit of that iron ore to make that runway with wagons and mules. There were no gasoline engines, there was nothing else. Only thing they had was those mules and those wagons. and all the neighbors and farmers got together, and they needed to make some extra bucks because it was a bad year that year for the growing season. So they got them a job, and they hauled all that iron ore and made a runway for that airport.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if that ain't two cultures colliding together in the 20th century, where they had the wagons and the mules and no cars, yet they were building an airport for airplanes?
Well, I mean, I'll have to verify this, but I'm pretty sure my grandmother, but I think it might have been my great-grandmother. Yeah, maybe my grandmother was a kid or whatever, or a baby. But I'm pretty sure she moved from Oklahoma to Texas in a covered wagon.
Probably did.
You know, that seems crazy to me. But if I think about it, you know, my grandparents are in their 90s, you know. The ones that are still here, if they were here, they'd be in their 90s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, during their lifetime, they saw, you know, the microwave, color television, you know, big screen TVs, high definition, you know, the internet, computers. I mean, like, if I just think about all the things that didn't exist when they were born and existed now or by the time they died, it's pretty mind-blowing to think about it.
Think about me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we had outdoor plumbing. You had to go outside to the outhouse to go to the bathroom. I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
There were no sewers. There were no plumbing, no septic system. Only an outhouse.
Yeah, and then you didn't have to pay these crazy City of Tyler water bills.
Yeah, no shit.
You know that they charge you based on sewage usage?
I heard.
And well, they have no way to measure that. If I'm watering my yard, I'm surely not using the sewer.
No, and I don't get it because they figured out a way to raise taxes without saying, well, I'm going to raise your water bill. We'll just call it a sewer bill.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's kind of like I had a discussion with one politician years ago. He was trying to say, well, we need to charge a fee. I said, fee is a three-letter word, just like tax is.
Hmm.
And if a government entity charges a fee, then it is a tax. And you're just trying to dust it up and say, it's not really a tax, it's a fee. But anytime you pay any money to government, it is a tax.
Yeah, a tax is a fine for doing good, and a fine is a tax for doing bad, and a mm-hmm. fee is just it doesn't make sense to me. You got to get a license to hunt and fish.
Yeah.
You got to ask for permission to collect rainwater. You know, you got to get permission from your local municipality to grow a garden in your front yard or whatever. You know, mm-hmm. So I saw a piece of property today for sale, and it said, cannot subdivide. You know, it was like 10 acres or something. I'm like, what do you mean you can't subdivide it? If you bought it, you do whatever you mm-hmm. want with it, right?
No.
Well, see, that's the problem is, you know, individuals can be intelligent, but groups of people are lowest common denominator intelligent, you know? Mm-hmm. And so the more people you get together, I think that's what's interesting about society, you know, like right now, everybody's all, you know, you're either super happy or you're super mad about what's going on in the United States with our government, you know, and I don't know that I'm super happy or mad. It's been, for
Neither
sure,
I.
It's been entertaining. What do you think about a Department of Government Efficiency? What do you think about old Elon and Trump and what they're doing?
I don't know what to believe.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to get an opinion.
Well, do you think we were really sending billions of dollars for condoms in Gaza, or millions of dollars?
Possibly. But, you know, I mean, it could happen. I mean, but that's not for me to rule out or rule in. My job is to make sure that my little corner of the world is okay.
Yeah.
I can't, all I can do is vote. How the vote goes after that, I've already done my part.
That was a Masonic thing too.
Yeah.
The whole idea of voting, wasn't
yeah.
it? I mean,
just
that
go ahead. You got to vote, and I'll vote, and how you vote, and the way I vote, doesn't matter to me. That's just the fact you did.
Huh.
And that's go ahead and people tell me, why you don't have much to say. No, I don't when it comes to politics, because as long as man has been put on this earth, he will have something to argue about who to vote for and how to worship God.
Hmm.
And I'm not going to get involved in political discussion with anybody, because I guarantee you, Donald J. Trump does not have a phone sitting there waiting for me to give him my opinion. He could care less what I think. And I'm not going to say I approve of him or disapprove of him. I can't stop him. I can't tell him, go and get it. I can't tell him and encourage him. He don't care. I am nothing. My voice means nothing. All my voice did back there when I voted. Okay? Made my voice, my vote count. Other than that, I can't worry about that. I've got to worry about Trey. And I got to worry about my children and worry about all my other friends that are hurting, and I've got to get down there and find out how can I fix it. And I tell everybody, I'm a millwright and an electrician. I can almost fix anything but break a day at the crack of dawn, but I can't mend a broken heart. Because if it has anything to do with God, I can't fix it. If God created it, I'm out. I do good enough to heal a stone bruise, much less anything else. But that's what God put me on here, to help somebody. And if it means I help you, I pulled that little girl out of water. Did I tell you about that?
Yeah, tell me that story. I think you told me before.
Okay, I'm going to give you a chain of events that only God could have done.
Okay.
The day before we were supposed to leave, a friend of mine calls me and said, I'm going to go to pick up some guys at the airport, and then we're going to take them to Palestine, and then we're going to come back to Tyler, and we'll go back to Palestine next day, which we had a big gathering down there. So, okay. The day we leave, he said, I changed my mind. We're going to pick up the guys at the airport. We can take them down there to Palestine. We're going to leave there and go to my ranch, which is in Pointer, and stay there. Okay. We changed that. That was the first change. We get down there, and a massive flood hits Palestine, just flooding everything, killing everything, and washing away. About 10 o'clock at night, and he says, well, maybe we need to go home. So we left, started going to his ranch. Second question. This is the second decision. Do we go 155 or do we go 315? I want to go 155. He wants to go 315. So we go down 315. And we get up that where that little road is, cuts off to Mount Abba, cut across it, went across that thing, and just as we topped the hill, we hit a tree limb. It landed on the road, and it busted in the size of the firewood, and we didn't know it, but when he run over the top of it, knocked a hole in a block. But we didn't know that. We were trying to assess the damage, but couldn't figure out what it was yet. We haven't stopped. We're still going. As we make a turn, we're making a curve, and we didn't know it. We didn't see him, but found out later that TxDOT was fixing to put a barricade up. And we just went by him just as he was about to put it up. So we missed him. That's the fourth thing. We go around the curve, and as we hit the curve, we start going down, and we hit a wall of water. It went over the hood of the Suburban, the Cadillac, not Suburban, but that Escalade, and come over into the windshield. We got 4 foot of water done, went over the top of us. And put out the lights on the Escalade. And I said, Randy, you're going the wrong way. He said, how do you know? I said, because you're going left, you need to go right. And he said, I don't know, I can't see. I said, well, I don't care, you need to go right. And about that time, the lights come on. I see, there's a reflector, go right, we got to go across that bridge. He went across the bridge. Went over top of the hill. Well, just as we're topping the hill, another little girl in the Mustang's coming the opposite direction down 315. She doesn't see it, but she runs into a wall of water down there, another wall of water, which we haven't hit yet. She hits it, it knocks her off of the road into the ditch. She crawls out of a window, crawls up on the bank. She grabs hold of a barbed wire fence. And she's trying to hold on for dear life because the water's trying to rush her off of
it. And you saw this happen?
No, never saw this. This is what she told me after we got there. But all this is going on the same time that we're coming down the hill. Randy looks at me and says, hey, we're dead in the water. Motor's no longer running. Well, I knew it was kind of running kind of rough. Well, the reason it was rough because it had a hole in the block. But the motor died. We coasted all the way down until we got down to the bottom of that hill down there. Finally got stopped. I'm a nervous wreck. I get out of the truck. I said, I got to get a cigarette. I got to get out. So I get out. And when I step off into the ground, I step into water. I look up in front of us, and there's a blooming river in front of us. That brushy creek had done filled up water and as wide as a river. I said, wow, look at that. So I went around the other side, stood there beside Randy, and I heard a little girl hollering, help me. That was her.
Hmm.
She saw us coming down with her headlight. She said, help me, help me. I looked at Randy, how am I going to help her? She's across the river. Who? He says. A girl is screaming, help. I don't hear anything, he says. I don't think no, but I think he's deaf. But anyway, I says, she's over there, and I'm going to try to figure out. You got a flashlight? I don't know. I can't find one, he says. Now, my truck is rigged out for any kind of emergencies. We're going on chasing hurricanes and tornadoes and everything else, so I've got all the equipment in there. He has nothing. Not in his truck. My truck, but in his truck. And I'm sitting there trying to figure out how to walk across that water and get to her. And about the time I start to make that decision, the water rushes off, pulls her off the barbed wire fence, rips her fingers with that barbed wire, and she's coming toward me. Fast. And all I can see is the flashlight she's holding in her hand as she's rushing down down the creek, shoving her toward me. And she got about 100 feet from me, and I heard her say, Mama, I wish I told you I love you before I died. Oh, Lord. I said, you're not dying tonight. That's when I looked up and I said, come to me. Come to me. Loud as I could. And it echoed all through that bottom. Just rattled the trees and everything when I said it. Randy looked up and said, God's here. She was coming fast. I said, I can't come. I'm tired. I said, you've got to come to me, I told her. Well, just as she got close enough to me, she was in about 6 foot of water flowing toward me, and she hit that bank right there, where there was a little bank right where I was standing. And she landed on it, and the water was picking to shove her back across it, and it was 20 foot of water deep behind her on past her. I reached and grabbed her hand and pulled her. She reached on to me. Dear life, literally. Randy turned around and said, you got her. I said, yep. I told you I had a girl coming to me. Now, she's sopping wet. I opened up the Escalade. I had some clothes back there. I said, here, I've got a T-shirt, make a nice dress. And some shorts, you can tie them on. And when you get dressed, come up in front of the truck. Me and Randy going to sit up in front and wait till you get dressed. So that's what we did. And for 4 solid hours, all we did was talking about Masons and Shriners and all kinds of things about kids. And she said, what do Masons do? And I said, apparently go around looking for damsels in distress in the water. Because that's what we do. We found you. And 4 hours later, the fire trucks finally showed up. And we had a discussion before you gone. And I told her, I want you to know that you have been saved by God, because there's something you're going to have to do in your life that you will have to serve him, and you'll have to make that decision. She says, I guess I will. I said, yes, because there's no reason I should be here. If I'd have been a minute off from the time that we come picked you up, you would be dead by now. The only reason I was here was because God placed me here. And she didn't really understand that. A year later, I heard that she joined the church, Church of Christ, going over in Athens, going to church, serving God. Never done been to church in her life. Yeah, we did good that night. God put me there to put there and bring her up. I don't know what great deed she will do that we'll ever know. Doesn't matter. All I know is that that was what we were supposed to do, and we did it. Just one of the many stories we got.
Mm.
But that was... I still look at that and grin. She's going to be good one of these days. It's all good.
Man, that's a wild story, Joe.
It's just, like I said, Every piece of incidents that happened was in within seconds of the time I needed to be there. Had we had the car running and didn't go out, didn't knock it out of the hole in the block, we'd have drove right through it and grown right through the creek. We'd have been right through that creek. We would have been probably washed away too. But instead, that car died right before we got to the water. Mm. The car was there when she had to come out. And when the firemen came, they looked in the Mustang. They thought she was dead. They went over and looked in the car. It was empty. Knew she was probably dead. 4 hours later, come driving that big old Ford fire truck through. And they said, "We're looking for you. Is your name?" She said, "Yes, sir. We've been looking for you." "Joe pulled me out of the water," she says. Joe pulled her out of the water. Mm. So those things.
You know, I had a similar experience last summer. We sent Lexi to some summer camp at UC Berkeley. And Michelle and I decided to drive all the way to Berkeley and pick her up, mm-hmm. and then go up into Portland, Oregon and see my buddy Rob Jones. And so we did that, and we went in and spent a night in San Francisco, and then got the kiddo and spent another day and night in San Francisco. And then we woke up early the next morning and took off, and we left really, really early because it was kind of foggy and we couldn't really see any of the cool stuff in San Francisco anyway, but we probably left too early in the morning to see the real cool Highway 1, 101 stuff, or whatever. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, I know.
We wanted to drive it. Well, it was too foggy and it was dark, and we ended up just taking the 101, I guess, the whole way. Right. We missed the scenic part, or maybe we were too far north of it anyway. I think we got a little confused on our directions, but right. We left early. And, man, we're coming up almost in Eureka, you know? And it's like, you know, if you've been over there, you know, there's ocean to the left, mm-hmm. you know, we're headed north. There's ocean to the left. And for most of that drive, it's crazy wooded forest, huge drop-offs on the left. And I was looking at my phone and Michelle started slowing down and I looked up. I'm like, there's no traffic. What's going on? It's probably like, I don't know, mid-morning. And she goes, "I think a 4Runner just ran off the road in front of us and went off the cliff." Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay. And so she kind of started pulling over and she's like, "Well, what do I do? Should I turn around?" I'm like, "Well, did a 4Runner run off the road or not?" She's like, we hadn't gotten a ton of sleep. We're 3 days in from Tyler, Texas to almost Oregon. You know what I mean? So we've been driving. We've been doing 1,000-mile days, you know? And she goes, I said, "Just turn around." So we pull around and we kind of look, we can't see anything. I said, "Stop the car." I hopped out and I looked down. Sure enough, there's a car about 40 feet down this mm-hmm. cliff, upside down, smoking.
Oh, my.
And I started to yell, "Hey, stay right there. You know, we see you, you know." And I turned around, and, you know, the kids had gotten out of the car. Michelle had parked. And I said, "Alexi, go out to the road and flag somebody down. We need help, you know." I mean, I don't even know if we had cell service. It was remote, mm-hmm. you know. And I kind of looked around and I thought, maybe I need to get something like a knife. I don't know what I might need down there, but it was a straight shot down, you know. And I turned around and, man, the very next vehicle after I told Lexi to wave somebody down was a, you know, California Department of Forestry fire truck.
Come up
with two guys in their early 20s, got out just wearing khakis and polos, and they said, "What's going on?" I said, "A car is down here." And one of them got out and looked over, and the other one started putting on his gear, you know. And the other one looked, and he just ran straight down the
hill.
Good
grief.
He didn't stop. He didn't assess anything. Just ran straight down there. And then he started calling, "Hey, I need something to break the window. You know, we can't get the window." I mean, we were like, man, how does two firemen, they don't even have anything to break? They didn't have anything in their truck to break the window. And right around that time, this girl pulled over. She just gotten some coffee, and she was a probation officer that was like paramedic and whatever trained, and she had combat boots on and like fatigue, you know. And she ran down there and had a windshield breaker, you know. And they got the guy out, and the guy's like had a scratch on his foot and a little cut on his ear, and he got those climbing out of the broken glass. Oh, he didn't even get him in the wreck. And they said, "What happened?" He said, "Well, I smoked some weed about an hour ago. Oh, no. He's like, I've been driving for 12 hours. I worked all day, and then I got in my car to go camping, and I guess I fell asleep. There was nothing. There was no indication that it had happened on the road.
I don't know.
You know, he just went straight off.
No tire strikes.
No, he just went straight off the
road. Y'all hadn't seen him. He'd been left there.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And could have easily gone into shock. But it was one of those moments. When we were on that trip, we were listening to the book. Hold on, let me look it up. We were listening to this book. I think it's I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist.
Yeah, I understand that.
I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, and it was recommended to us earlier in the summer. It said Norman Geiser and Frank Turek. You know, Frank Turek is both those guys are apologists or whatever. Frank's a pretty solid guy. I think there's another author on that one. I don't know. Probably whatever. Well, right. I'm not very good at citing stuff, but it'd been recommended to us because Michelle was trying to figure out, you know, whether she believed in God or not.
Yeah.
And, you know, she just, for the rest of that trip, she was just like, man, if I hadn't seen that, you know, and I'm like, well, hey, you know, don't you see that, like, there are no coincidences in this life? That don't you see that God does what he does? And, I say all that to say this, that yesterday, Easter Sunday, April 20th, 2025, we're sitting at the 9 o'clock service here, and yesterday was the 20th, right?
Yeah.
We were sitting at the 9 a.m. service, and at the end of that service, Travis, you know, the whole sermon seemed like it was almost pointed at my wife, and then the end of the service, he said, well, hey, everybody put your heads down, you know, and if you've been, you know, if you're not sure about this, or you don't know if you're saved or you're not saved or whatever, you know, he kind of gave the deal, and he goes, hey, you know, repeat after me, say this prayer, and he goes, when you get done, just look up at me, you know, and, you know, he got done, and then he prayed, they played, you know, and then, you know, I look up, and all these people are kind of coming around me, and I look behind me, because I was sitting in front of Lexi and Michelle was crying, and I'm like, what's going on, you know? And she's like, I did what he said, you know? Oh, wow. So this Easter, Michelle got saved. But yeah. It's interesting, you know, it's like another story about a car running off the road, essentially.
That's wonderful.
What a weird deal, huh?
Yeah, you never know what's going to happen. I wish we had knew what God's plan was, but he's got the plan, won't let us know about it.
Well, you know, I think there's something to that spiritual mystery, you know. I'm pretty comfortable in not knowing the solution or the answer or what even the direction is, you know. Just as long as he gives me a couple steps every day, you know, right. Hey, this is what I got for you. But is there anything that you want to put out here while we've got you on the podcast, or have you pretty well covered it?
We covered a lot, but the main thing is that don't believe everything you read. Don't believe everything you see.
Do your own investigation.
Yeah, because it amazes me that you can take ignorant people, and I didn't say stupid. Ignorance means it's just don't know. You haven't got the education yet. I'm ignorant of how to fly in that 747. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean I'm stupid. It just means I'm ignorant. I don't know how to fly in a 747. But these guys are coming up here, and all they're doing is trying to make money off of it, just like the Discovery Channel trying to make money off the History Channel, trying to talk about how bad Masons are and all these evil things we are. And all it does is just sell. Hmm. It's a sales pitch and marketing. And too bad we don't know how to do marketing, because Masons would be the best marketing. The guys would go, look, we don't do that. Well, if you say you don't do that, then what do you say you didn't do? I said, well, I'll make up everything up. And I was sitting there going, I had a guy sitting there telling me the 33rd degree. All you people. He was telling me the 33rd knows everything. They're controlling everything. And I'm looking at him like, really? I must not have been paying attention, because I don't remember anybody telling me I could control anything. And as far as this demon worship, I don't know where he come from. But he can go back wherever he come from, because I don't care nothing about all that mess.
Well, they say that, you know, morals and dogma, you know, kind of outlines how we worship Lucifer.
Yeah, well, I could get into that because I know what he's talking about. People who read the book don't know what he's talking about, so they make up their own stories behind it. And we could get into that another day, and I'll tell you about it. But it's first 20 pages, it's talking about how this commercial greed of the leadership of the state would bend the state toward commercial greed and eventually would get the whole country chasing commercial greed and eventually be hated by the rest of the world. This is written in 1868.
Mm-hmm.
What are we doing now? We're in total commercial greed worldwide. And now we're being hated by the rest of the world. The man was talking about something that would happen. How that the banks would take all the money from the people, and once they got it devalued so to the point where it was useless to anybody else but them, the banks would be taken care of. They wouldn't run out of money. They'd have plenty of it. And then they would have a lot of money, but it'd be worthless until they got it back valued up. But in the meantime, the paupers would lose their homes. They'd take their home. The bankers would buy their homes for a song, take over and foreclose on those houses for nothing because the dollar was so devalued. And then after they got all that, their wealth that they wanted to accumulate, then they'd put the valuation of the dollar back in again. What happened in 2008?
Mm-hmm.
So and then they had a savings and loan thing, and no bank's going to go broke. No bank is going to go broke. Even the biggest one, back there when a bank failed, and they were sitting there going, oh, woe is me, the banker's going to lose all their money, we're going to close all their money. No, they didn't. The government took care of that. They're not going to go broke.
Well, Midland Savings and Loan did, but the bankers loaned themselves a bunch of money and never paid it back.
That's what I'm talking about. They take care of themselves before they take care of any of us.
Hmm.
So we paupers not going to get that.
It's usury.
Exactly.
Usury. Yep.
Anyway.
If you don't know what that is, look it up.
Look at it. Anyway, it's been fun.
All right, Joe. Well, thank you. And y'all, this has been another episode of Two Dudes, One God Pod, and we'll see you next Friday.